Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
Even the other convicts liked our little Jew, although absolutely everyone without exception laughed at him. He was our only Jew, and even now I cannot recall him without laughing. Every time I looked at him, I would think of Gogol's little Jew, Yankel, from Taras Bulba, who, when he had undressed to get into the cupboard where he slept at night with his little wife, bore a striking resemblance to a chicken. Our little Jew was the spitting image of a plucked chicken. He was a man no longer young, about 50 years old, short, weak, cunning, and at the same time positively stupid.
That's a passage from Dostoevsky's Notes from the House of the Dead. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Most of us are familiar with Jewish stereotypes in Western literature, such as Shylock in Shakespeare's The Merchant of Venice or Fagin in Dickens' Oliver Twist. How did Russian writers expand on these portrayals? Joining us to explore Jewish stereotypes in Russian literature is Gary Rosenshield, professor emeritus of Slavic literature at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's the author of Western Law, Russian Justice, Dostoevsky, The Jury, Trial, and the Law, and is finishing a new book entitled Gogol, Turgenev, Dostoevsky, and the Ridiculous Jew, a study in the exploitation and transformation of the Jewish stereotype.
Exploitation and transformation, that right away sounds like something's going on there. How did you get interested in this topic?
Well, originally I was going to write a book about the representation of the ominous and dangerous Jew of the second half of the 19th century. And as many writers and scholars do, they go back to an earlier period to see the origin. Tolstoy did this
for
War and Peace. Yeah. And he was interested in the December's Revolt of 1825, and he needed to study the Napoleonic Wars. And he wrote 1,500 pages about that and never wrote about the December's Revolt of 1825. And an even more famous example is Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov. Dostoevsky wanted to write a novel about the youngest brother, Alyosha, and said that he couldn't write the novel about Alyosha until he had written the prehistory about Alyosha's two brothers, which is the first volume of The Brothers Karamazov. The second volume was never written. So I'm not equating myself to either of these two writers. But when I did my first book on Pushkin, I had wanted to write a book about madness. I wrote a book about Pushkin and madness. I wanted to write about the second half of the 19th century. I thought I'd go back to the origins in the first half of the 19th century, and I got stuck there, and I wrote just about Pushkin and madness. And the same thing happened with this book. I was originally going to write about the image of the Jew in the second half of the 19th century, this very ominous stereotype. I can read a passage from Dostoevsky which describes this perfectly. And I went back to the origins of the image in the first half of the 19th century and found that the image there was different but more interesting ideologically and aesthetically than the image in the second half of the 19th century. And therefore, I just wrote about the first half of the 19th century, especially because the writers represented there are such important ones for Russian literature and world literature, Gogol, Dostoevsky, and Turgenev.
Now that's the first half of the 19th century. Is that where really Russian literature has this burgeoning, or is there some reason there are not these images before then?
There are images before that, but they're rare, and you're right. The origins of modern Russian literature are the beginning of the 19th century. And Pushkin often is viewed as – he had predecessors, of course, but he's usually viewed as the father of Russian literature. So Russia gets started quite late with respect to the Western literary community, but the origins are really in the first half of the 19th century.
I know you've also written about The Merchant of Venice as well. Would you say that Shakespeare's Shylock is important when you turn to these Russian authors? Are they kind of responding to picking up on that image?
Well, I think that both Gogol and Turgenev are responding in part to Shylock. Gogol very specifically uses quotes from Walter Scott. And as we know, Walter Scott's Ivanhoe is very, very dependent upon Shakespeare's image. And he tried to change the image to give a more positive interpretation of the Jews of the Middle Ages. And Walter Scott's novel Ivanhoe was the most popular novel of the first quarter of the 19th century. So it was tremendously influential. And when Gogol decided to write a historical novel about Russia, he turned, obviously, to Walter Scott and the followers of Walter Scott. And there are some quotations in Gogol's Taras Bulba, the novel that I work with, which are directly taken from Walter Scott and his depiction of the Jew, which go back to Shakespeare's famous quotation about the Jew and being human, and when he's pricked, he feels the same thing as any other human being. And many of these authors do, in effect, the same thing that Shakespeare does, willingly or unwillingly, where they explore the stereotype, and the stereotype sort of gets out of hand and turns into something different from what they originally intended. Usually it was intended as a comic device. The Jew is a villain. But as we know, Shylock essentially takes over the play, even though he disappears in the fifth act. And the same thing with the Jews in these works, that they start out as mere comic devices, but they develop into something much more against the intentions, I claim, of the author, and make us view the works themselves in a very, very different way, even undercutting the basic ideology and goals of the authors themselves. So this is why I became so interested in these types, is because they just weren't stereotypes, they weren't images, but they were integrated so closely into the aesthetic structures of the work and undercut many of the basic ideas of the authors that immediately it spurred my interest.
How subversive of these characters
subversive.
To do that.
Yeah. That's why I call, especially in Turgenev, it's the revenge of the stereotype. The stereotype turning against the author and undercutting the author's own goals and ends.
Well, Pushkin was a bit of an outsider as it was being part African. So he was not a typical Russian. Did that make him more or less sympathetic with Jewish characters, do you think, in the long run?
Great Russians had very little contact with live Jews in Russia because they were not permitted to enter the interior of Russia until in the 1850s, 1860s, and only then in small numbers. That many of your listeners will recall that most of the Jews were confined to the Pale of Settlement, and they weren't permitted to move out of the Pale of Settlement into internal Russia. So most Russian writers, except for the Ukrainians, and Gogol was a Ukrainian, had almost virtually no contact with Jews until the 1860s, which is past the time of the subject of this book. When they did have contact with them in the 1860s, the image of the Jew, for various reasons, changed, part of which was the increased participation in the cultural and economic life of the country, yes, in small numbers, but with great influence of Jews in the 1860s and the 1870s.
So what are they basing these images on? Just images that they picked up second, third hand?
Yes. You don't need to have Jews to have anti-Semitism, and you don't need Jews to have literature about Jews.
So
there weren't that many Jews in England in the 1590s, but Shakespeare, could write about them in response to a work by Marlowe, the Jew of Malta, who probably had even less contact than Shakespeare had with Jews. So it's possible to write about Jews without Jews being in the country, just as it's possible for there to be anti-Semitism without Jews.
Well, the passage we opened with, which was from Dostoevsky, refers back to Taras Bulba by Gogol. Can you tell us about that work, what it's about, and what the Jew, whose name is Yankel, adds to the discussion?
Yes. One of the most interesting things about Taras Bulba, it's a historical novel and it's an epic. And it's supposed to, and the main function of this epic is to glorify the Russian spirit. And Gogol writes an historical novel. He goes back to a mythical 14th, 15th, 16th century Russia and describes the ideal Russian. And the ideal Russian for this time was the Cossack, because the Cossack was, in Gogol's representation, the most important defender of the Russian land and the Russian church and the Russian people from the Catholic Church and the invaders from the south and from the east, Tartars or Turks. And one way that Gogol depicts the positive characteristics of his Cossack heroes is to contrast them with various negative others, women, Poles, Turks, priests. And the most significant other for Gogol in this novel is the Jew. And so the Jew becomes a very important character because he defines, we call it by negation, the most positive character, Taras Bulba. One thing that I found in Gogol's integration of the Jew into the novel is that the association of this Jew who's represented pretty much the way Norman read that passage about Dostoevsky's Jew, where, remember, Dostoevsky says he took his Jew directly from literature, that it seemed uncanny that the Jew, the only Jew in this prison camp that he met, was the spitting image of the image that Gogol had created in Taras Bulba. And so the Jew is small, he's weak, he's ineffectual, he's funny in his gestures, he's funny in his speech. He's not taken seriously. He's not an existential character. He's used basically as a comic device. But one of the things that happens in Taras Bulba is that there is what I call a Jewish infection, that as the hero associates more and more with this comic character, a lot of his status as an epic hero is lost because he gets into these interesting dialogues where they're almost like Abbott and Costello routines. Mm. And so here Gogol is trying to establish the status of his epic hero. At the same time, the Jew is undermining the status by his comic nature. Another thing is that I chose Gogol because the most famous passages about Jews in Russian literature, not in Russian journalism, the most famous passage in Russian journalism is a passage by Dostoevsky that perhaps we'll read later, is the passage from Taras Bulba, which speaks about the Jews being thrown into the river and drowned by the Cossacks. This is perhaps the most famous passage in Russian literature about Jews, and perhaps I could read it. The Cossacks here are reacting to Yankel's speech, where he sees that the Jews are in danger of being hanged or killed in one way or another, and he intercedes and says, "How can you react this way to us when we Jews are your brothers?" Now, there's nothing worse that Yankel could have said in this situation, because the Cossacks essentially identify themselves as non-Jews, and therefore the association is something that they react to as though one is taking a match to a piece of dry wood. "The poor sons of Israel, losing what little courage they had, hid in empty vodka barrels, in ovens, and even crept under the skirts of their wives. But the Cossacks found them everywhere. 'We have never had any dealing with the enemy,' the tall Jew, that is Yankel, went on, 'and we don't want to know anything of the Catholics. May they dream of the devil. We have been brothers with you.' 'What? The Dnieper Cossacks are your brothers?' one of the crowd shouted. 'You'll never see that, you damn Jews. Into the Dnieper with them. Comrades, drown all the heathens.' These words were the signal. They seized the Jews by their arms and began flinging them into the water. Painful cries rang out on all sides, but the hard-hearted Cossacks only laughed at the sight of the Jews' legs in slippers and stockings kicking in the air."
Now, what was the basis for – I realize there's this contrast between Cossacks and Jews, but what was the basis for that virulent anti-Semitism, either real or imagined?
Well, Gogol was a Ukrainian and actually had more contact with Jews than any other major writer of his time. And the Jews, as you may or may not know, were middlemen in the areas of the Pale of Settlement, and they maintained an independent status and had their own communities, and their ways of life and their language and their mannerisms were diametrically opposed to some of the populations among whom they lived. And so here, where we're dealing with a comic image of a Jew, the Jews are in the Pale of Settlement. As far as the Russians are concerned, they're self-contained, and they don't represent any significant danger. And therefore, it's easier for them to see them essentially as alien and different and funny. The way they dress is different, the way they speak. They speak Yiddish, which sounds strange to Taras Bulba, who sounds like the language of the devil. When they do speak Russian, they speak with an accent. They have a different religion, which is different in many ways from Russian Orthodoxy. And so Gogol is fascinated with them because he's interested in comic characters. I mean, this is his stock and trade. And the Jew is sort of another interesting comic character that he can use. And actually, he places him in a novel where perhaps he doesn't belong, because it goes against the goal of producing a Russian Cossack hero. And he doesn't want to do anything to undermine him. But in the end, he does, by infecting him with the comic antics of this Jew.
But how is it comic? Like the passage you just read where they're being thrown into the river, I saw that the Cossacks were laughing at that.
Yes.
But Gogol standing behind that, is he approving of the Cossack reaction, or you can't quite tell?
I think he's probably neutral to the Cossack reaction. He understands exactly why they laugh, because he presents Yankel as ridiculous. And the main point that's being made here is that the Jews are ridiculous in everything they do, and they are ridiculous in the most important thing for all Cossacks, which is death. Because any Epicuro, the most important thing in the life of any Epicuro is how he dies, the fame that he receives as a result of death in battle. In Greek, it's called kleos. And for Jews to be ridiculous in death is really the worst thing that one can say about another ethnic group. And that which is most important to us, they are not even worthy of serious representation. They are just laughable.
You mean because of the legs sticking?
Yes,
here and
so when right. And there are other descriptions of death, and there are descriptions of death of other groups of people who are presented as antitheses to the Cossacks, for example, women. But when women die, and there are descriptions of their death, they're presented very seriously and existentially. I can read a passage to you to show you exactly the difference. What Gogol says here is that the Tartars raid some churches, and they take the women and children and put them to the torch, and they throw up the little children and catch them on their spears. And Gogol says that even the Russian steppe, the grasses of the Russian steppe, bow down in sorrow to see such terrible cruelty. And now Gogol justifies the Cossacks' actions. They had to be cruel and they had to be merciless in order to defend Russian territory. It was necessary at that time. But Gogol clearly sympathizes with these women and children who are being killed with the Cossacks. This passage, however, is a very significant difference. Here we have Jewish death, but even in death, Jews are only ridiculous. And because they are ridiculous, they can't be taken seriously. It's almost a mechanical reaction that the Cossacks have. They don't laugh because they are not laughing maliciously. They're not laughing because they want to see the Jews die. They are laughing because the Jews are ridiculous as they drop into the Dnieper, and you can see their stockings and their feet. The Dnieper is a Cossack territory. It's Cossack land. It's a Cossack space. That's where they ply their trade. They're pirates who go down the river and maraud. The water is not a Jewish element. Jews can't swim. So therefore, this is the appropriate place as far as the Cossacks are concerned for them to be killed. And to them, this is just funny. There's another passage in the novel which undercuts this representation of Jewish death as being ridiculous. It's one of the most important passages in the novel, similar to the one I just described about the women who are being killed and their children being thrown up on and being caught on the swords of the Cossacks, where Gogol represents the suffering in a Polish town which is being besieged by the Cossacks, and the people inside are dying of starvation. And one of the Cossack who betrays the Cossacks enters into this town and falls upon the starving people all over the ground. And he sees one Jewish woman and her child dying, and there's a very sympathetic representation of this Jewish woman described in very, very differently from Jewish women who are presented as funny and ridiculous in earlier passages. And this is the most existential representation of death in the entire novel. Now, whether Gogol intended to do this or not, but one thing that it does, it shows that even Gogol can represent Jewish death differently. He can represent it not only not comically, he can represent it seriously and existentially. And it undercuts many of the things that he's doing in the novel by presenting it in such a serious way. That the Jews are not always comic, they can be serious, and therefore this dichotomy that he sets up between Jews and Cossacks actually breaks down seriously in some of these passages. And when we look at the novel, probably we have to look at it in a very different way, when we see that the author can present Jews in a more serious way, but chooses to present them most of the time in not such a serious way. So it was in the realm of possibility for Gogol to represent Jews differently.
But did he do that in a progressive way, meaning that do you tend to get the comic Jews earlier in his writings and the more serious appearances later? Is there a continuity there, a progression, or are they just sort of in no particular pattern?
There are no particular pattern. Gogol's greatest works were written within 7 years, and so it's really hard to talk about a progression. You know, the earliest about 1835, 1836, when some of his best stories come out, and he basically finished writing in 1842, any artistic works. And there's an early version of Taras Bulba, 1836, and the version that we read is from 1842. And although there is more depiction of the Jews in the 1842 version, they're depicted in probably exactly the same way. So it's hard to speak of any evolution in the image of the Jew when it's over so short a period of time. And I think this is an aberration. It's sort of a mistake. In other words, it's sort of he didn't want to go there, but something in him took him there. Just as we can say of Shakespeare, we don't know whether this is true or not, he probably didn't intend originally to take Shylock in all the directions that he did. Some were unintentional, probably, and the unintentional directions that he took him are probably the best aspects of the characterization of Shylock. And so one probably can make a case in Gogol here that this ambiguous representation of the Jew is probably the most important aspect of the representation of the Jew in this work, rather than the one-sided comic representation of the Jew, as we saw in the passage, where even in death, Jews were ridiculous.
Well, I can see, though, where, and I mean, I've seen it even in other things that started out light and then the characters develop, but I can see where an author would feel compelled to develop a character as fully as he or she could, and that would include somebody who was originally sort of a caricature. The impulse, the author's impulse would be to round out that character.
Yes. And Russian literature is famous for doing exactly that. In the 1840s, Dostoevsky himself took it as his task to give a much more positive and rounded representation of the clerk that Gogol had described in The Overcoat, for example. And later on, when Dostoevsky wrote Notes from the House of the Dead, which I discuss in the book, and Isai Fomich, a lot of later Jewish critics, both in the 19th century and the 20th century, took Dostoevsky to task for writing such a one-sided or two-dimensional character in Isai Fomich when he had presented characters very similar in status a decade or two decades earlier in the 1840s and had treated them so sympathetically. If he had treated Dyevushkin in Poor Folk so sympathetically, why couldn't he extend the same sympathy and the same roundness of character to Isai Fomich, the Jew, in the prison camp as he had done earlier in his earlier works?
Good question.
Yeah. And so there is actually a novel written in the 1970s. It's called Summer in Baden-Baden. It's a novel by a Russian intellectual who's riding on a train, reading the diary of Dostoevsky's wife about her experience with Dostoevsky in the first year of their marriage in Baden-Baden, which is a German resort. And what the narrator does is he confronts the image of Isai Fomich from Notes from the House of the Dead and asks this question: how can I revere this writer who has presented my people in such a negative way? How could Dostoevsky not have extended his sympathy to this character when he had done the same thing to other characters in the 1840s? Moreover, that Dostoevsky himself, if we look at his biography and if we look at Anna's diary, was very similar in many ways to Isai Fomich. And therefore, why couldn't he even see that Isai Fomich had many of the same characteristics that he himself had? And therefore, why couldn't he describe it more sympathetically? So this is a big problem that has extended beyond, you know, the realm of the work itself and the century itself, and has become a preoccupation even in the late 20th century.
Sounds like a psychological question.
More on Jewish stereotypes in Russian literature when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
The businesses, professionals, and organizations that support Wisconsin Public Radio's programming play an important part in our financial health. For more information about corporate sponsorships, visit wpr.org/underwriting.
If you prick us, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do we not laugh? If you poison us, do we not die? And if you wrong us, shall we not revenge? The words of Shylock in Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Gary Rosenshield, and we're talking about Jewish stereotypes in Russian literature. We were talking about Gogol, and you also have referred to Dostoevsky and the fact that the most virulent passage, the most anti-Semitic passage that you can point to in 19th century Russian literature comes from later Dostoevsky. Can you give us some sense of what that is, what it is that Dostoevsky is moving toward?
Yes. One of the interesting contrasts that my book deals with is the essential difference between the image of the Jew in the first half of the century and the second half of the 19th century. And we see this change in image in one author. In Dostoevsky, who follows essentially the path of Gogol, he says he takes Yankel directly out of Taras Bulba and insists on the harmlessness of his Jew and the comic nature and ridiculous nature of his Jew. But in the 1860s, and especially the 1870s, he reflects an entirely different view of the Jew, a Jew that is ominous, a Jew that is dangerous, and in competition with Russians, both economically and culturally. And maybe Norman can read a passage which reflects Dostoevsky's later views. Dostoevsky had certain ambivalences about Jews, and there is a positive or relatively positive section to this article that he wrote about Jews called The Jewish Question. But it's really overweighed by the negative images, and here is one of them.
It is not for nothing that over there Jews are reigning everywhere over stock exchanges. It is not for nothing that they control capital, that they are the masters of credit. And it is not for nothing, I repeat, that they are masters of international politics. And what is going to happen in the future is only known to the Jews themselves. Their reign, their complete reign, is approaching. We are approaching the complete triumph of ideas before which the sentiments of humanity, thirst for truth, Christian and national feelings, and even those of national dignity must bow. On the contrary, we are approaching materialism, a blind, carnivorous craving for personal material welfare, a craving for personal accumulation of money by any means. This is all that has been proclaimed as the supreme aim, as the reasonable thing, as liberty, in lieu of the Christian idea of salvation only through the closest moral and brotherly fellowship of men.
Can you explain where Dostoevsky would be getting that sort of stereotype, of a very long-lasting stereotype, yeah, the idea of the Jew as greedy, as obsessed with money, as hoarding wealth and power?
Yeah. Well, the image of the Jew as a materialist is longstanding in European literature. The idea of the Jew as a symbol of the new materialism, 19th century materialism and capitalism, is more of a recent idea. None of Dostoevsky's ideas about Jews is original. They're all taken from the anti-Semitic literature of Western Europe and Russian literature and culture, which was heavily influenced by German and other Western European thought. French utopian socialists. There are anti-Semitic French utopian socialists, and Dostoevsky was influenced by them. So we see that Dostoevsky is not the only one spewing this hatred in his publications. There are others as well in Russian journalism, as well as in Western European and Eastern European journalism. But none of what he says could you not find in other anti-Semitic publications of the time. So very often people tried to address the question of Dostoevsky's anti-Semitism. But as far as its content is concerned, you can see it everywhere. It is in no way original. It's very secondhand and borrowed.
Well, if we see some of these character traits that are undesirable, weakness, physical weakness, greed, and cowardice, there is nonetheless implied in much of what Dostoevsky was saying there about these crafty Jews, there is a strong implication of intelligence.
Yeah. Right. And if you look at that quote, you see it's the exact antithesis of his representation of the Jew in an earlier period of his writing. He wrote Notes from the House of the Dead, which is a semi-autobiographical novel about his prison experience in Siberia from 1850 to 1854. And during this experience, there was one Jew, only one Jew in his prison camp. And he, in his memoirs, or semi-autobiographical memoirs, he includes a portrait of this one Jew. And what is interesting what he says about the Jew is that he took him lock, stock, and barrel from another work of Russian literature, Gogol's Taras Bulba, implying that his Jew, in reality, actually fit the image that Gogol had created. And therefore, the best that he can do to describe him was essentially describe him in the same terms as Russian literature had described him earlier. But of course, he adds things that you don't find in Gogol. But one thing that Dostoevsky does emphasize, that everything that he says there, obviously, you find the antithesis here, that the Jew is comic, He's harmless. He constitutes no danger or threat whatsoever to Russia. He is not in control of the stock exchanges. He is not a ruling capital. He doesn't own all the banks. He's not in control of foreign policy. He's not Disraeli, you know, controlling English foreign policy against the interests of Russia and so on and so forth. He's entirely different, the antithesis of the image that he creates only 15, 16 years later.
The description that we opened with from that work where it says our little Jew was the spitting image of a plucked chicken. Yeah. He was a man no longer young, about 50 years old, short, weak, cunning, and at the same time positively stupid.
Yes.
That's a pretty damning description.
It's a damning description, and most of the descriptions that follow that emphasize the comic aspects or the ridiculous aspects of this character, that the prisoners treat Yefimovich, they don't try to harm him. Because he is so comic and ridiculous, they treat him as a pet, and they tease him as they would tease, as Dostoevsky says, a pet parrot or a pet dog. That's how seriously he's taken. And over and over, Dostoevsky emphasizes this point, the harmlessness of him and the very fact that he is a constant source of amusement and in no way like any of the Jews that he would later describe in the 1870s.
Does he, in this prison context, not have anything to offer the other prisoners other than his status as a pet? I mean, there's no exchange of services that he can participate in.
Well, one of the things, the point that I eventually make about Dostoevsky is the same thing happens in Dostoevsky's novel as happens in Gogol's novel, that there is an attempt to depict him in one way and to use him as a device in describing other characters, the Russians, for example, as an antithesis to the Russian, and Jewish spirituality as an antithesis to Russian spirituality. And also in this work, Notes from the House of the Dead, there is a surprising representation of Islam. That the most positive, the most spiritually pure characters in Notes from the House of the Dead are Muslims. And they are the ones who most contrast physically and spiritually with Yefimovich. It's a very interesting technique that Dostoevsky uses here because the Russian prisoners couldn't be used as perfect representatives of Russian Orthodoxy. Most of them were brutal killers, or many of them were brutal killers. They just didn't fit the role. But he does find perfect embodiments of his ideal of Russian spirituality in these Muslims who are not really Russians. And they serve as a dramatic contrast in almost every respect with Yefimovich. So Yefimovich is used as an antithesis, just as Gogol used Yankel as antithesis to his positive characters. And one of the most famous passage in Notes from the House of the Dead has to do with the representation of Jewish religion. And it's a representation of the celebration of Yefimovich of his Sabbath. And I have a passage here, maybe it might be of interest to you, to see how Dostoevsky represents the Sabbath, trying to present the religion of the Jew as inconsequential, unserious, unexistential. Every Friday evening, convicts came to our ward from other parts of the prison on purpose to see Yefimovich celebrate his Sabbath. Yefimovich was naively vain and boastful that this general interest gave him pleasure, too. With pedantic and studied gravity, he covered his little table in the corner, opened his book, lighted two candles, and muttering some secret words, began putting on his vestment. Westment, as he pronounced it. It was party-colored. It was a party-colored shawl of woolen material, which he kept carefully in his box. He tied phylacteries on both hands and tied some sort of wooden arc by means of a bandage on his head, right over his forehead, so that it looked like a ridiculous horn sprouting out of his forehead. Then the prayer would begin. He repeated it in a chant, uttered cries, spat on the floor, and turned around, making wild and ridiculous gesticulations. All of this, of course, was part of the ceremony, and there was nothing inherently ridiculous or strange about it, but what was ridiculous was that Yefimovich seemed purposely to be playing a part before us, and made a show of his ritual. Suddenly he would hide his head in his hands and recite with sobs. The sobs grew louder, and in a state of exhaustion and almost howling, he would let his head, crowned with the ark, drop on the book. But suddenly, in the middle of the most violent sobbing, he would begin to laugh and chant in a voice with feeling and solemnity, a voice weakened by a surfeit of joy.
It seems to me that's a Russian device that you see, at least the first half of that passage, that description, what is it called, ostronenia? It's of estrangement, yeah. Where you're describing something that may be fairly ordinary, say an opera. I mean, yeah. Tolstoy does that, yeah. in War and Peace. Yes. But you describe it through the eyes of somebody who really doesn't get it.
Yes.
And inevitably it becomes comic that way.
Right. And although he says that there was nothing inherently ridiculous about the ceremony itself, the description presents it as being ridiculous.
And he repeats that word ridiculous three times,
yes.
in what you read. The Russian word for that, is it? Does it match well with our term ridiculous?
Well, the Russian word smishnoy means comic, funny, or ridiculous. It can mean all three. And the way you translate it in English is based on the context. So comic can be just funny. Ridiculous implies the concept of ridicule. And so here I think ridiculous and its connotations with ridicule are probably appropriate.
And you would argue then that toward the end of the passage, when we see the sobbing and the solemnity, that it becomes something a little bit more?
I think it doesn't become more serious. What he's arguing here is that it's all a show. That this is a really sincere, passionate religion, that he's putting on a performance for the prisoners, and that he's doing this because he knows there are people watching. That if there were no one there, he's implying, he wouldn't do this. So it's just theatrical, and one of the things he presents Isai Fomich as basically an actor, a theatrical person, and here is an ideal way of showing off to the prisoners. And they come every Saturday to watch this show. They enjoy it so much.
And how does that fit then with, I guess, with anti-Semitism or with this sort of this stereotype? What does this add to it, in your opinion?
It shows a great deal of disrespect for the practice of another person's religion. The ritual of a person in one religion always seems a little strange and in some cases ridiculous to a person of another religion. And so as you noted, that there is a presentation from the outside. Someone is presenting it as though it was weird and funny and therefore would be of interest and amusement to his reader. So I think when you present the religious practices, the serious religious practices, and the Sabbath is the most important day for Jews, in this comic manner, you essentially diminish it and malign it.
And is the same done then with the Muslim characters?
No, it's actually the opposite. The Muslims are the representatives of the highest form of spirituality. That actually Dostoevsky used the Muslim characters here as his prototype for some of the most positive characters, Christian characters in his novels. So Prince Mishkin in The Idiot, who probably Dostoevsky's most positive Christian character, is based on one of the Muslims in Notes on the House of the Dead, Alyei. And Alyosha Karamazov, also heavily influenced by the representation of Alyei in Notes on the House of the Dead. It's rather strange to hear this
right.
about Dostoevsky and
yes.
the representation of Muslim spirituality. That Dostoevsky in the 1870s had a very different view of the Muslims, especially because of the wars that Turkey and Russia always were fighting with each other. And there had been some sympathy for the Turkish side represented in Russian journalism of the 1870s. So Dostoevsky took a more negative attitude towards the Turks and Islam in the 1870s out of political and journalistic considerations. But here in 1862, it's very interesting for him to present probably the most positive representation of Islam in Russian literature.
And then so the Russians you were equating with Christians, and they're just possibly not alien enough to be interesting for the author?
Dostoevsky is interested in Russian spirituality, but with these prisoners who are very often brutal criminals, he can't use them as exemplars
yeah.
of Russian. But he does show the potential for the highest manifestation of Christian feeling, even in the prisoners. It doesn't manifest itself often, but it does manifest itself a few times a year. And that's enough for Dostoevsky. Dostoevsky tended to idealize Russian peasants, but he understood the reality as well, and therefore he never would state that the Russian peasant who came to represent to him the epitome of what Russian spirituality could be in glorified terms. He never distorted the image of the Russian peasant. He always said that the Russian peasant had the seed of great Christian spirituality, had the potential to become a great Christian, but Russian peasants needed the help of others in Russian society to realize that potential. And so these prisoners who have tremendous potential, perhaps more potential than any other Russian peasants in the population, do show signs of significant spirituality, Christian spirituality, especially at Christmas. And there's a whole section in Notes from the House of the Dead devoted to the celebrations at Christmas. but it's under a significant thick husk, and it only manifests itself, it only reveals itself at specific times. But this is Dostoevsky's idea about the Russian peasants. You know, they have been oppressed for many centuries. You can't expect them to be exemplars of Christianity. But once they are given enough food and treated respectfully, they can show the way for all other classes in the Russian population toward a new understanding of Christ and a new spirituality. And Dostoevsky has said that, you know, the Russian peasant will save the Russian Christianity of the Russian peasant will save the world.
We'll look at a third major Russian writer, Ivan Turgenev, and see what his images of Jews are in his writings when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
PortalWisconsin.org lists almost 1,000 cultural events in Wisconsin. Find out which ones you want to see at PortalWisconsin.org. Portal Wisconsin is a service of Wisconsin Public Radio and the other partners in the Cultural Coalition of Wisconsin.
A caricature of two Jews in conversation. It's part of the pictures at an exhibition of Modest Mussorgsky, the pianist there, Sviatoslav Richter. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Gary Rosenshield. We're talking about stereotypes or caricatures of Jews in Russian literature, but of a slightly earlier era than the Mussorgsky, which would have been circa 1875, but the general idea is still much the same.
Yes, I think so. And you asked me earlier whether I saw anything relevant in that musical representation with what I'm talking about. And my first reaction was to say that maybe the music was more consonant with what Dostoevsky was saying than anything in the first half of the 19th century. But actually listening to the piece, I see that there's something in Gogol's Taras Bulba in there, that when Taras Bulba is in Warsaw being housed amongst Jews, he listens to their conversation. And the impression that he has seems to be represented quite well in that piece that you just played.
How so?
Because he sees it as strange and as alien and as cacophonous and as gibberish. And there's a certain contrast of a high and a low.
Yes, and that kind of modal, exotic quality,
and
too.
Modal, exotic quality. Alien, perhaps. Yes. This is my initial impression.
Well, I suspect that's what Mussorgsky had in mind, too, was something that would create that effect.
Now, we've talked about Gogol and we've talked about Dostoevsky. What about Turgenev?
Okay, Turgenev is perhaps one of the most interesting players in the creation of anti-Semitic or anti-Judaic images in Russian literature, because Turgenev, in contrast to Gogol and Dostoevsky, who were for the most of their lives conservative, Turgenev was a liberal and a representative of Western thought. And it's surprising to find that the most negative of the images that I deal with in this book is to be found in a short story by Turgenev called The Jew. And so what Turgenev does, he takes almost all of the negative physical characteristics of the Jew as we find them in Gogol and in Dostoevsky, and he actually exaggerates them. So the physical Jew that you find in Turgenev is much more negatively represented than even Yankel and other Jews in Taras Bulba. And he also emphasizes the reprehensible moral characteristics of the Jew to a much greater extent than Gogol does, and of course much more than Dostoevsky, because Dostoevsky talks about his Jew being essentially harmless and not dangerous. And Turgenev does this for probably a very definite reason. He would later write some stories in which Jews participate where they're more positively presented in the 1860s and the 1870s and consonant with his liberal status. But this is a story, an early story from the 1840s. And the question one asks is, why is Turgenev doing this? And my basic take on this is that Turgenev is writing a story against capital punishment. and that he's taking the Jew, not arbitrarily, but as a representative or someone who could be presented as negatively as possible. And, and the stereotype is very convenient for him here because he can present a Jew and it will be accepted by this Russian population as morally reprehensible and physically repellent, and use him as the main device to perform an experiment to see whether the death of any man is not serious, is not existential. That we saw in Gogol that the Cossacks just laughed at Jews dying. It didn't affect them one way or another. The only way it affected them is that it was amusing. And even in Dostoevsky, we saw that in what was most important for Dostoevsky, which is religion, he presented Isai Fomich, the representative of the Jewish religion, as essentially ridiculous in the performance of his Sabbath prayers. And here, what Turgenev does, he has a story where a Jew, after he finds out that the narrator of the story has won a lot of money at cards, tries to use his daughter as a way of wangling money out of the narrator. He never intends to compromise his daughter, but he's engaged in a very risky business. And this is presented in very, very negative terms. Also, he is caught spying against the Russian army. This takes place during the Napoleonic Wars. And all spies were summarily hanged on the same day. And when the general of the Russian troops, who's of German origin, finds out that Yishel, who is the anti-hero of the story, has been spying against Russian troops, he orders that he immediately be hanged. And so we have a scene, another execution scene, in some ways similar, and Turgenev is explicitly taking that scene from Gogol and transforming it, in which we see the execution of a Jew. And the Jew, as Turgenev writes, is ridiculous just as Gogol described him in Taras Bulba in death, but he tries to represent that ridiculousness in a very different way. And so Turgenev says, "The soldiers took Yishel under his arms. I understood then why they had been laughing at the Jew when Sarah, his daughter, and I came running from the camp. He was really ridiculous," and Turgenev uses the word smishoy, or smishon, "in spite of all the horror of his situation, the tormenting anguish of parting with life. His daughter and his family expressed itself in the unfortunate Jew in such strange and grotesque gesticulations, cries, and skips that we all smiled involuntarily, though it was horrible, oh so horrible, to us too. The poor fellow was half dead with fear." So I think you can see how Turgenev is using the scene about Jewish death, and no matter how reprehensible he presents Gyosha morally and how negatively he presents him physically, and I do have some passages which I could read where he describes everything associated with the Jew in the most negative terms possible, comparing him to rabbits and other fowl and chickens and so on, similar to the representation you saw in Dostoevsky. But nevertheless, the Cossacks here, and they are Cossacks, even though this is the Napoleonic War, do react very differently from Gogol's Cossacks. They actually, despite themselves, laugh, but feel compassion for him, because in this moment of death, everything that is incidental in our lives, you know, our culture, our language, our religion, is erased, and everyone recognizes themselves in the death of the Jew. And so Turgenev uses this image. It's a terrible image, but he uses it for this experimental purpose, to show a certain common humanity between Jews. They're human beings despite who they are or what they are. And the Cossacks instinctively feel this and laugh against their will, in contrast to the Cossacks in Gogol, who just thought it was a very amusing experience.
And why did you find Turgenev the most? You said that despite the fact that he was liberal, his representation of the Jew was more negative. How is that more negative?
Because Yishel is caught spying against Russian troops. I mean, he's a Judas.
So that's mm-hmm. as reprehensible as you can get.
That's as reprehensible as you can get.
So Turgenev makes him not only ridiculous, but dangerous.
But dangerous, yes.
And yet he's still making a statement about capital
yes.
punishment.
And dangerous, and that he is a very inept spy. And one of the reasons why the narrator tries to intercede for Gershel is that it seems that he is an inept spy, and that's why he was so easily caught. And it seems that way he may have been doing it one time before this or two times, we don't know. But it doesn't seem that he's a professional spy. It just seems that he's doing it, you know, for purely economic reasons. But nevertheless, the association of Jew as a traitor and the Jew as a Judas is very entrenched in this story.
And do you find reading these kind of passages now with sort of post-Holocaust eyes,
yeah.
do you find that you see in the attitude toward Jewish death something that kind of foreshadows what will happen in the 20th century?
Yes, I think these images of Jewish death were engraved very deeply in the minds of 20th century Russian writers. That most of the images that we have in the 19th century, and that's true for the first half of the 19th century as well as the second half of the 19th century, are the images of non-Jews, of Jews. In the 20th century, where Jews rise to prominence as writers, especially after the revolution, they begin to confront the image of themselves as represented in the literature that they have inherited and have adopted as their own. And obviously, this is extremely disturbing. And so a very prominent writer of the 1920s, perhaps the greatest Soviet prose writer of the time, Isaac Babil, in his story about the Russian Cossacks of the 1920s, describes many scenes of Jewish death where he presents the death existentially. But Russian writers continue to confront their image of Leonid Sipkin confronting the image of Dostoevsky's representation of Isai Fomich in Notes on the House of the Dead. But in the most famous Holocaust novel written in the Soviet Union in 1978 by Anatoly Rybakov, which describes the extermination of the Jews of the Ukraine, there are many passages where Rybakov takes the image of the Jew from Turgenev and from Dostoevsky, and especially from Gogol, and completely transforms them into giving an image, a positive image of Jews. So the Jews are the exact antithesis of how Gogol describes them. They're not scrawny. They can be hefty and strong and stalwart. They're not weak and they're not cowards. They're courageous and they do things more courageous than any other Russians in their confrontation with the Germans. And in fact, Taras Bulba dies at the end. He's tied to a cross by the Poles who capture him, and he is burnt at the stake. He's crucified. And as he dies, he calls out to his fellow Cossacks to continue the fight against the Poles. So it's a martial crucifixion. And it's not accidental that Rybakov, in his representation of the Jewish rebellion or fight against the Nazis as much as they could possibly fight in those circumstances, uses an image which is very similar to the one that Gogol used. And perhaps I can read a little bit of that. It happened, the inhabitants of the ghetto were all lined up on the square where a cross had been erected. And this obviously is a direct reference to Taras Bulba. They brought Dina out, naked, beaten, covered in blood, her face a bluish color. They tied her to the cross. At the sign from Stalba, who is the German commander, the executioner hammered the first nail into Dina's hand. Dina fainted, and Stalba ordered water to be thrown over her. They poured water over her, and she came to. He struck her with his lash. "Maybe you'll sing all the same." She had been a singer before the war. And Dina started to sing. No, it wasn't singing. A wheeze came from her chest, and blood came from her throat. They had damaged her lungs. She choked, wheezed something, then wheezed something again, all the time getting quieter and quieter. I couldn't say what it was she was trying to sing. Maybe a Jewish song, or a Ukrainian or a Russian song, or perhaps the Internationale, the hymn of our youth and our hopes. Dina hung dead on the cross for 3 days. And so Dina has been transformed into a Soviet martyr, the new martyr for the Soviet age, taking the place, as it were, of Taras Bulba for the earlier age of the 19th century. And here it is a Jewish girl, one of the others for negative others, women for Gogol, here representing the most positive aspect of the Russian or Soviet resistance against the Germans in the Second World War.
So quite the transformation from those caricatures of the early 19th century. Our guest this hour has been Gary Rosenshield, giving us just an idea of the many portraits of Jews in Russian literature, especially in the early 19th century. Thanks for an illuminating hour.
My pleasure.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.